based on the inspection, we actually went in and took action under the Alaska statute to immediately revoke their license.
The state finds unsafe conditions at an Anchorage nursing home. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 18th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a leasing program for geothermal projects in the West.
Alaska has a lot of geothermal resources being located around the Pacific Ring of Fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The state is taking over management of the Mary Conrad Nursing Home in Anchorage following a routine inspection. Beverly Woolley is director of the Alaska Division of Public Health. She says conditions there present an immediate danger to the health, safety, and welfare of the residents.
We found physical injuries that were untreated. There were problems with medication distribution. The food quality, there were issues with that, as well as unsanitary conditions in the kitchen. And then there were also some possible administrative problems that were identified.
Three residents were hospitalized, but Woolley says none of the injuries appear to be life-threatening. 88 people live at the long-term care facility. A Seattle company called Raindance Healthcare Group bought the nursing home and took over its management in February. The state revoked the company's operating license this morning and escorted the director of nursing services and the administrator out of the building. Woolley says Raindance can appeal to get their license back.
We'd want to ensure that the residents' safety and their health, welfare, and safety is of paramount importance, and they would have to meet all licensing requirements and assure us that that would be able to take place.
The state has brought in 8 nurses and other staff to help with care at Mary Conrad. Providence Health and Services operated the facility for 20 years before Raindance took over this year. Shell Oil has announced that they intend to file for a rehearing to the full Ninth Circuit after their exploration plan for the Beaufort was halted in November. In the November decision, 2 of 3 judges said the Minerals Management Service had not taken a hard look at the cumulative impacts to habitat and migration routes for marine mammals, waterfowl, and wildlife, as well as impacts to subsistence for the Inupiaq people of the North Slope. Shell will attempt a new court challenge, but in the meantime says it will nix plans to pursue drilling or seismic testing in 2009. Shell Alaska General Manager Pete Slaby says their appeal is substantiated by the dissenting opinion.
You see that there is this kind of a red thread through the decisions the courts have made before where they are substituting their own expertise for that of the regulator, in this case the federal regulator. We believe that the MMS has done a very, very thorough job on looking at our case.
Slaby says their outer continental shelf work has been done successfully, and the Ninth Circuit's current decision is the exception, not the rule. He says their plans to halt 2009 exploration will mean about 700 jobs and millions of dollars will not flow to the state. Slaby says it's not entirely clear how many of those jobs would have been North Slope residents.
Can't give you the exact number of North Slope residents, but be impactful, and you know clearly over 100 of these people will be Alaskan residents.
Slaby says they have to file before the 4th of January, and it will take 30 to 60 days for the Ninth Circuit to decide if they'll grant the hearing. North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta was not available for comment by airtime. Some Southeast officials say their communities are shortchanged in the governor's capital budget proposal, but they say it's just the first step in a long process that will get dollars to public works projects in the region. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Governor Sarah Palin's capital budget includes about $130 million for projects in southeast Alaska. Some of the money covers community needs, such as harbor work in Ketchikan and water and sewer system improvements in Pelican. Other projects serve more of a statewide purpose. Those include repairing the Mount Edgecombe Boarding High School in Sitka and remodeling a youth detention center in Juneau. The projects make up about 7% of the statewide total, which is about $1.9 billion. Some lawmakers say that's not enough, especially for a region dependent on government spending.
That's the economic engine that keeps our cities afloat.
Republican Peggy Wilson represents Sitka, Petersburg, and her hometown of Wrangell in the House. The budget gives Sitka about $6.5 million, Wrangell $400,000, and Petersburg almost nothing.
I'm kind of used to that. Last time, I don't think there was hardly anything for District 2 in the budget. So we'll put more in, and we'll see where it goes.
A lot of the governor's budget is for transportation. The largest southeast project is about $13 million for work on Ketchikan's North Tongass Highway. Juneau gets close to the same amount, but for several projects, including Glacier Highway, Egan Drive, and Thane Road work. And Cake gets about $10 million towards a road and ferry connection that could someday link it to Petersburg. Lawmakers say that's all needed, it's just not enough.
I think it is a first cut that is going to bear absolutely no relationship as to what the final cut will be.
Juneau Democrat Kim Elton serves on the Senate Finance Committee. He says the legislature will add numerous community projects before it adjourns in mid-April. And he says Southeast is in a good position to get its share.
The majority leader in the House is from Southeast. The co-chair of Senate Finance is from Southeast. The vice chair of House Finance is from Southeast. I do not expect that we will get into a position in which this region is going to be disadvantaged in the budget.
Many of the projects traditionally in the capital budget are still being discussed at the community level. Local leaders will submit them to lawmakers, who will also hear from nonprofit organizations, business associations, and other groups. The governor's office says the spending plan reflects state agency requests, not a system of community allocations. Budget Director Karen Rehfeld says it's a starting point for work with the public and the legislature, and the administration understands lawmakers will work to achieve more balance. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Even with state earnings expected to be much less than last year, the Corrections Department is looking for more in its budget. Corrections wants an increase in funding for treatment programs in the state's jails. Commissioner Joe Schmidt is asking for a 1% increase in their operating budget this year. That amounts to about $1.3 million.
There's about $380,000 in a cost of living increase for the out-of-state contract. Mental health services is about $400,000, and substance abuse about $500,000.
Substance abuse programs in the state's jails were canceled a few years ago under the Murkowski administration. Schmidt is trying to put them back and add some new ones. The commissioner is an outspoken proponent of slowing down recidivism rates, or the revolving door factor of people going back to jail over and over again. He says one of the ways to curb that problem is to not just house them in jail, but treat them. He says 92% of the state's prisoners have substance abuse issues, and 42% are mentally ill.
I know it's many members of the public question, you know, why would we want to buy a program? Why would we want to spend resource public dollars on something like that? But when such high percentages of the prison population has issues with mental health and with substance abuse, and many times both together, you know, like it or not, they are a big liability to the state. And we think that if we put these programs in, even if a small percentage of them stop coming back to prison, those programs will pay for themselves.
Last year, the legislature okayed about $500,000 to start up 5 substance abuse programs in jails. They will be housed in facilities in Bethel, Seward, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage. They are in the bidding process right now with the hopes that the programs can start up by next summer. In this new budget, Corrections is asking to fund 4 more programs. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, another victim of newspaper industry cutbacks.
It's kind of sad to think that, you know, we're losing a weekly tabloid entertainment section, which has been around for, I don't know, longer than I've been in Juneau.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States.
The Interior Department has finalized a plan to make 190 million acres of federal land available for geothermal energy projects, including lands in Alaska. The leasing program is going into effect in 12 western states. Officials say the leases could lead to development of 5,500 megawatts of new electric generation capacity by 2015. Geothermal power taps hot water and steam beneath the Earth's surface to produce energy. The hot water can also be used directly to heat homes. The Interior Department says under the new plan, which was finalized yesterday, some federal areas will remain off limits, like monuments and national parks, such as Yellowstone, which is known for its geothermal geysers. Most of the land, about 111 million acres, is under the Bureau of Land Management. Another 79 million acres is managed by the U.S. Forest Service. BLM's National Geothermal Program Manager Kermit Witherby says there is significant potential beneath Alaska's federal lands.
Alaska hadn't really been looked at before, but Alaska has a lot of geothermal resources being located around the Pacific Ring of Fire and a lot of volcanic activity and hot springs, and decided we needed to look at federally managed lands in Alaska for the potential of leasing, you know, applications that may come down, you know, in the future.
Witherby says the plan opens up more than 5 million acres in Alaska to leasing. He says there's already interest in southeast Alaska on Bell Island, which is part of the Tongass National Forest. Developers want to make a 20-megawatt geothermal power plant that could help power Ketchikan. Witherby says there are other patches of Alaska with geothermal activity.
The major potential in Alaska, I believe, spread in sort of a long ellipse from the Seward Peninsula eastward and then out on the Aleutian Islands and a few other areas.
Witherby says the main hurdle to tapping geothermal power is the lack of infrastructure. Some areas with potential are far from power lines and grids.
You may not have electrical transmission corridors and lines in, but they may be available for, you know, local uses for mining operations, or local communities could acquire federal leases to develop geothermal leases for space heating or electrical generation, much along the lines of what has been done up at Chena Hot Springs.
Chena Hot Springs Resort outside Fairbanks has harnessed the naturally occurring geothermal power to water to power the resort. It's a unique project because the water is at a lower temperature than typically used in geothermal power projects. It's seen as a model of how moderate temperature projects can work. Witherby says officials with the Interior Department will hold workshops and open houses in the 12 western states in a few months to talk about the leasing possibilities. Junoites who enjoy reading about the capital city art scene are running out of time. The last issue of The Hooligan came out today. The Juno Empire has discontinued the weekly art supplement as part of the newspaper's cost-cutting measures. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
The Hooligan has its fans. They appreciate its irreverent look at the arts and entertainment enjoyed mostly by younger adults in Juno. Critics don't appreciate its sense of humor or its embrace of party culture. The Hooligan's survey of public bathrooms in Mendenhall Valley bars comes to mind. But it wasn't potty humor that dragged down The Hooligan. It was financial troubles at the Juno Empire's parent company. That's Morris Publishing Group in Augusta, Georgia. Empire publisher Bob Hale says his paper remains profitable, but the Empire has been slashing its product and its staff to cut costs. Morris Publishing is loaded down with debts, and its advertising revenue is in steep decline. One Wall Street analyst told KTOO that Morris has a better than 50% chance of going bankrupt by next summer. Corey Keeker was The Hooligan's first editor. He's now an editor at Consumer's Digest in Chicago. He says he wanted to do something with The Hooligan that no other newspaper had done.
We definitely didn't want to model it after anybody, because pretty much every newspaper that has an entertainment section does a really poor job, because it's really usually condescending, or people who are too old to try to appeal to younger people, or I don't know. You just it is kind of lame if you look at any leisure section in any newspaper.
The Hooligan will be replaced by an arts and culture section in the paper on Fridays. The Hooligan will continue in name, at least, online. But with zero budget to pay freelancers, the online version may be thin on content. Here's Hooligan editor Eric Morrison.
It's kind of sad to think that, you know, we're losing a weekly tabloid entertainment section, which has been around for, I don't know, longer than I've been in Juneau. And, you know, I can't imagine that this community is not going to have an appetite for knowing about the arts, because a lot of people care about it in town, obviously. So we're still going to try to cover it the best we can, but we're doing less with less now.
The paper is also eliminating its outdoor section and reducing its coverage of sports to local sports just 3 days a week. The Empire laid off editor Ken Lewis and education reporter Alan Suderman last week. Management also announced that two unfilled positions were being eliminated. Suderman declined to comment on the Empire cutbacks. He says a separation agreement prohibits him from saying anything negative about the company. Such gag orders are not uncommon when private firms lay off employees. But Suderman did say the thousands of layoffs at newspapers nationwide don't give him much hope for the industry's future.
Obviously, as a reporter, I feel like, you know, it's a pretty vital function that reporters play in terms of keeping the public aware of what's going on. But I don't know if everyone shares that view.
Alaska's biggest newspaper, the Anchorage Daily News, has reduced its staff by 40%. Last week, the ADN announced it would be reducing the size of the paper by cutting the Sunday outdoor section, among others. At the Empire, other staff are being pushed out without the benefit of an official layoff or a severance package. Sources at the paper say publisher Bob Hale ordered an employee on the advertising staff to quit, or else he would lay off one of her coworkers. Hale declined to comment on staff reductions at the Empire. Morale is reportedly down at the Empire because of the layoffs and the treatment of employees being forced out. As for the decision to shut down the Hooligan, Corey Kieker says it's lame. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Chilista, the native for-profit corporation for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, announced that all elders are getting holiday checks worth $250. The checks started going out in the mail Friday. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Elders in this case means shareholders 65 years of age and older. It's the first time that Chilista has given out a check just to elders. Andrew Guy, vice president of Chilista, says the decision came from shareholder feedback.
About 2 years ago, we had an annual meeting, and we had a question in there whether or not our shareholders would be in favor of having some kind of benefit for our elders. A vast majority of our shareholders responded yes, they would be in favor of having an elders benefit program of some kind. And based on that, the board of directors decided to give out a special distribution to the elders this year.
There are approximately 1,500 elders in the Chilista region. At $250 each, that's a total payout of $375,000. This is separate from an annual dividend, which Guy says comes from the 7i Fund. That's a pool of shared earnings from all 13 regional corporations in the state. The elders' Christmas check is from Chilista's recent earnings.
Well, Chilista has been making money these past several years, and the benefit is being paid out of the money that Chilista has made.
As for another dividend for all shareholders, Guy says that's always a possibility.
Board of directors can always declare a distribution or a dividend.
Last year, that came in the springtime after year-end financial statements were finished. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The Sitka Assembly's triennial debate over purchasing new police cars took a new turn this year. The Assembly steered clear of its usual discussion of whether the community was over-patrolled or underserved, and instead discussed whether the time was right to try out hybrid patrol cars. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt didn't think the hybrid police cruiser's time had come.
The police industry hasn't embraced hybrids at this point in time. really we'd be out in front. They're not being employed very much down in lower 48, and I thought it would be very risky to try to be out in front with hybrids at this point in time, possibly 3 years from now.
Schmidt went on to explain that the Crown Victorias used by the department now were equipped with special police packages, engines, transmissions, and most importantly, electrical alternators to handle 24-hour, 365-day duty. He said that some of the radios and other equipment in the existing three cars could be shifted into the new vehicles. Schmidt said he had begun research on hybrids when he purchased the current Crown Vicks in 2005. He believed hybrids still had a long way to go.
We don't have mechanics trained to deal with these vehicles. The unions don't like these vehicles because of radio interference problems they've had in lower 48. So the industry is not really ready for this type of vehicle. Will they last 175,000 miles? I don't know. As far as them being more practical and costing less money, they're probably going to cost more money and end up not saving us that much money for gas either.
Schmidt said that two of the vehicles in service now had 125,000 miles, the third 107,000 miles. He said maintenance costs on the cars had tripled over the 3 years that they had been in use, and the department was now beginning to look at transmission and axle replacements that he did not consider cost-effective. While no one on the assembly wanted to dictate to the police department what kind of vehicles they should use, member Jack Osmond believed it was time for the city to start putting its money where its mouth was as far as global warming was concerned.
I get the feeling that we're municipally not really buying in to this problem. Here in Alaska, where we're actually in the forefront of this battle, if you will, I think we need to show some being up front and not have to wait for Missouri to buy police cars.
Osmond reminded the assembly that they had a citywide greenhouse gas inventory prepared last summer and referred to other legislative measures the group had taken to address global warming, including signing the nationwide mayor's agreement on climate protection. Larry Cruz wasn't on the assembly when it last took on climate change issues. He simply considered hybrids untested for police work.
I mean, I'm all for the hybrids and stuff, but I think that I much prefer to see them proven themselves someplace else. You know, take a bigger city that's got the money to pay for these things. You know, we don't have the money to pay for this kind of newness out here. And you're putting it in a police department car, which, you know, that's an emergency response vehicle. And I would not want to see something like this jeopardize, you know, a call.
Assembly member Cheryl Westover said she didn't mind waiting 3 years, and she hoped the chief would keep an eye on the police market for hybrids. Phyllis Hackett, who earlier in the discussion had proposed possibly requiring one of the three cars to be a hybrid, said she agreed the type of vehicle ultimately was a departmental decision.
It's certainly not my call. I would just like to encourage, as Mr. Osmond said, the city to be a little more responsible in that arena, and anything we can do to encourage that, I would support.
The money for the three new cars already exists in the Central Garage Sinking Fund. Chief Schmidt said it would take several months from the time the cars would be ordered until the time they were ready to roll. The current dark blue cars were acquired in a surplus order from the Anchorage Police Department. Schmidt said he expected the new cars would be white. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Real trees remain a popular Christmas tradition despite a tendency to dry out and drop their needles. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service is offering advice on how to keep them looking good through the holidays. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Several factors can determine how well a tree holds its needles once it's brought into the house. University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service forester Bob Wheeler says it all begins with species. He says some varieties make better Christmas trees.
The spruces are very susceptible to needle drop and rapid temperature variations. Typically in the lots, you'll see a variety of species. Some will have lodgepole or scotch pine, which are kind of intermediate on their needle retention. You have grand fir, and grand fir is a little bit more susceptible to needle drop than Douglas fir, and then much more resistant to needle drop is noble fir.
Wheeler says it also matters how trees are fertilized and watered up until harvest time. Most real trees you find at stores in Alaska were cut in the lower 48 back in October. Wheeler says it's best if they're not exposed to temperature extremes once they are cut. He says it's easy to ruin a tree that's traveled thousands of miles to Alaska on the ride home from the store.
If you can grow them, harvest them, have them semi-dormant, and transported above freezing, that's probably an ideal tree. But the problem is when you take the tree out of where it's being stored inside above freezing and are taken outside and it's minus 20 or so, you can really cause rapid needle loss.
Wheeler says for those who cut their own trees locally, it's best to gradually warm them to room temperature in an outbuilding or garage where the temperature can slowly be brought up over several days. He adds that trees need a lot of water once they're warmed up above freezing.
The demand for water on a tree will vary somewhat by species, but typically a rule of thumb for this is a quart of water per day per inch of diameter of the base stem of the tree.
Wheeler says a cut tree left out of water will scab over in as little as 2 hours and need a fresh base cut to enable water absorption. He says there's no scientific evidence that adding anything to the water helps prolong the life of a tree. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Budget constraints at the U.S. Customs Office in Anchorage almost forced the cancellation of Japan Airlines' winter flights to Fairbanks. Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau Tourism Director Colin Lawrence says the flights, which begin December 27th, had been denied permission to land until this week. Lawrence says at issue was the cost of Anchorage-based agents to process the Fairbanks flights.
Seems like it was primarily just a budgetary and staffing issue to accommodate and process a 747 full of visitors. That can be 350 people all at one pop. And while we have the great improved international processing facilities at the Fairbanks International Airport, we still need the bodies to actually be in the booths and do the work.
The issue reached the governor's office, and the U.S. Customs Commissioner agreed to provide the agents for the Japanese Airlines flights. Japan Airlines is increasing the number of winter charters it flies to Fairbanks from 16 to 18. Lawrence says that's encouraging, given the beleaguered state of the airline industry.
Travel industry worldwide is sort of collectively holding its breath about next year and how it's going to shape up to be. In terms of the economic situation worldwide, but for us, we're looking to be fairly solid. Right now, the yen is extremely strong against the dollar, so it's a good deal for them.
Lawrence says the JAL flights could bring more than 6,000 visitors to Fairbanks this winter. The passengers are part of packaged tours that run from $1,500 to more than $3,000 for four-night stays. Lawrence says aurora viewing and dog mushing are top draws. The Japanese visitation amounts to several million dollars in local economic impact. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and John Ryan in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.